Pantheon is an auditory feast where you're expected to leave any and all reservations at the door. We will explore a different theme each week based on concepts found in literature, music, and mythology. So for those seeking an adventure, tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM on Thursdays at 8 p.m., and I'll see you there.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Ramtin Mochtahedi, who is doing a PhD in computing under the supervision of Dr. Amber Simpson. Welcome to GradChat, Ramtin.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And hello to our wonderful audience. And I'm so excited to be in this version of podcast and happy to discuss my research with you and all of our wonderful listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate your time. And I'm excited to learn more about all of the interesting work that you're getting up to in computing. Can you tell us more specifically about what your research topic is or what the focus of your PhD is?
Absolutely. At a higher level, my PhD thesis contributes to how to do an effective liver cancer management. And in this field of research, there are three main pillars, which as an engineer and also with the background of AI, someone with my background could contribute to the field, besides some of those clinical aspects that are already being done on the other faculties. And I would categorize those three main contributions in the field, in the pillars of, you know, finding and detecting cancer tumors, which means that reliably you find and outline the boundaries of a cancer tumor inside the imaging data that you are working with. In this case, the most widespread and most common one are CT images and CT scans. And this field is known as segmentation and segmenting cancer tumor, because this is the first part of any sort of therapies or treatment plan, is to understand and detect the cancer tumor, understand that where are the tumor are located.
That makes sense, right? You can't treat it if you don't know where it is, or
Absolutely, yeah. And then the next step is to understand what are the different types of the tumor. Because liver cancer primarily consists of the primary cancer tumors and the secondary cancer tumors. Primary ones are such as hepatocellular carcinoma or HCC, and the secondary ones are those cancer tumors that are initially being originated and generated and produced in other organs rather than just liver itself, such as colon or kidney or whatever. And then cancer tumors are kind of transferred from those organs and then back to the liver. So they are actually being spread by the other to the other organs into the liver and or metastasize inside the liver. So it's very important to kind of classify and categorize those type of tumor, because when a clinician, when a doctor actually being assessed the cancer stage and wanted to decide how the treatment plan could be, they need that type of information to understand that where actually cancer is originated. Mm-hmm. If it is primary, then focus on the liver itself. If it's secondary, then focus on the organ that actually generates the cancer tumors at the initial stage. So the treatment plan is quite different. Mm-hmm. So that is actually the main part of my second contribution, which was the focusing on classifying cancer tumor into the primary and secondary. And the third phase is how you could use those extracted and detected cancer tumors into something that predict the outcome of the patient, which means that doing the survival prediction by assigning risk scores of the event. The event could be death or, you know, just being fully treated, so that by assigning those risk scores to each specific patient, you could have a better understanding of the outcome of the of the patient. So my research has been focused on these three pillars. By focusing on the deep learning based approaches, how develop those deep learning based approaches to kind of contribute in any of these areas. So that was a high level of how I my thesis actually contributed to the field.
That makes sense though, right? Like you said, again, I think it's really combining all of the different areas and knowledge backgrounds that you're bringing to these to help clinicians better assess, categorize, and predict outcomes for patients, which ultimately leads to better patient care. That's in my opinion, right? That's what it sounds like. Yeah. So as that was high level, like you said, if you were going to explain your PhD to a friend or a family member, how would you describe the problem you're trying to solve in liver cancer care and what your computer program actually does with a CT scan to help doctors? Because you mentioned, the big picture and like those large goals. But for someone who's maybe less familiar with deep learning and machine learning and cancer care in general, what would you tell them?
Absolutely. So usually when I explain my PhD to a friend or family, I usually start with the problem rather than the algorithms or details behind that to be understandable by someone who is not expert in the field. So because liver cancer is a serious disease and one of the main tools that clinicians and doctors use to manage it are the imaging, particularly in our case, are CT scan images. A CT scan is like a 3D x-ray of your abdomen.
Okay.
And a radiologist usually need to scroll through hundreds of slices looking for tumors and then measure them and then track how they actually being changed over time. So right now, and back to the traditional methods and analysis actually have been used for a long time. The process is mostly depends on the manual labeling and imaging and manual labeling of the images.
So someone going through and marking things and looking with just their eye, the naked human eye, right?
Exactly. Okay, needed the human eye, and it actually, the process is very time consuming and cost effective, and it's not consistent because it heavily depends on the radiologists and who assess the images. And also, even in some cases, very skilled doctors, they might disagree with each other on the exact boundaries. So I would say the algorithms and the approaches, particularly in my case, deep learning based approaches that I have developed, are basically trying to act as a very fast and very consistent helper beside to the clinicians. And then when you fit a CT scan into the algorithm that I have developed, the first thing it does, it actually finds the liver and then highlight it, and then within that liver organ it actually detects the tumors inside the liver and then outline them either in 3D or 2D, and it turns that CT scan into the clear map so that it roughly says how big those tumors are, and it helps them to be and how they are actually distributed, and it helps them to get a better understanding to the clinicians at the very, you know, very first initial sites of this checking and assessing the CT scans. And then on top of that, also it helps to appear of those tumors and give some suggestions what their type could be, and then which I said that it could be related either they are primary or secondary type of the cancer tumors. And then in some cases, it helps from the past patients. It can estimate how risky are those tumors look like and how risky and how severe is the situation, and gives a clinician at the very site, phase of the insights to understand that how severe is the disease. So that these are the broad overview and perspective of how my research actually being contributed, so that the non-experts, for those non-experts, it's not for replacing doctors, but also in my case is to being like an assistant that can do repetitive measurements and outlining, and also providing clinicians with some quantitative numbers and leave the final interpretation and decision making to the clinician team to make those type of the decisions to be much more effective, much more optimized, and much more informed decisions.
No, that sounds great. And I think that's something that's helpful to note, because I think some people might be afraid of the idea of maybe machine learning or an AI tool making decisions, but of course not. It's in the it's a tool within the hands of a very well-trained clinician or an attending physician who's going to make the ultimate decision. But your tool is helping them make that faster and giving them more evidence on which to base their decisions. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. That's totally right.
So yes, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So me as someone who is definitely a non-expert, thank you for sharing the more non-expert definition of your work. So it sounds like your program has to do a lot of work in labeling, categorizing this wealth of images from CT scans that you're getting. How does your research help AI learn about liver tumors and CT scans, and how does it become more efficient at learning what it's seeing?
Absolutely, yeah. One of the biggest bottlenecks in medical AI is having access to labeled data or annotated data. Because when we train and develop an AI-based model, either it's in the class machine learning, traditional machine learning-based models or the deep learning-based models, is that the model needs to be trained by using the annotated data, which the technical term is supervised learning. It's called supervised learning. And to train a traditional segmentation model, you need experts to carefully draw the liver and every tumor on each slice of hundreds of thousands of CT scans. Mm. And that can take an hour, even more, per even one case.
Wow.
And even if there is some, and as I said, even a very kind of skilled clinicians and radiologists can, in some cases, there could be some disagreement between those experts. And it is not realistic to label everything at that level of the details. And it's not possible based on the expenses and the time burden of the process. So my research tries to make a better use of those data. We already have by reducing the dependence on the dense of the labels and by using computationally efficient training strategies. One part of this is called in machine learning realm, it's called the self-supervised learning, which means that instead of asking the network to immediately learn exact tumor boundaries, I first ask it to solve simpler tasks on large collections of unlabeled scans and using some of the methodologies such as reconstructing mask out regions or recognizing when there are two different views or aspects of the views of the same CT scan, so that and then train the model based on those unlabeled data. And this process helps the model learn the basic structures of abdominal CT images without having access to labels at all. And it learns the edges of the tumors, some of the shape-related information of the tumors, the context of the tumor, the location and spatial information of the tumor. So it learns those type of information or those those type of initial information just by using the on-label data. And so that because the model have that initial understanding of those tumor, now the model doesn't need that large of annotated data to be trained on. And then it could kind of, because it has those general features and general understanding of the feature, then I only need a smaller label data set to fine tune the model to do the precise segmentation and do the segmentation to find the boundaries of the tumors, which is in the case that just training the model from scratch, I need a much more, 10 times, 100 times more data to kind of train that specific model to do the same work and give us the same output. So that this is a part of the efficiency and also things that I have been working on that. And also another thing is that I would like to highlight here is having access to the large language models. So just to non-expert audience, LLMs or large language models is the field of the AI, which focuses on training some AI models on millions of the data. And they have retained of the very large billions of data in the past, including natural or medical images or whatever. So the model have that initial understanding. And what we are asking is how we could customize and adapt those large language models to be specifically fine-tuned and specifically work towards our specific task, working on the CT images that we have, which is abdominal raw CT images. And then I have been working on optimizing those models by just integrating some specific small modules inside those models, and then instead of training the full model, all parameters and all parts of those models, just training some small parts of those models, and then adapt them towards our specific task, which in this field, in a technical term, it's called the parameter efficient fine-tuning or PFD of those LLMs. And then I fine-tune them towards our liver tumor task, which means that, for example, for large language models, you don't need to large data to be trained, because you can use those large language models which have been trained on billions of data and then just fine-tune it towards our specific task, which makes the process much more efficient and much less needed to annotate the data in the process.
So it sounds like you have been very strategic in how you have developed the models you've both been trying to make the models efficient, but you've been efficient in how you have trained the models to become optimized by thinking about the best ways to use the data available and the fastest ways to get the most accurate results in training your model. Is that fair to say?
Yes. That's totally right.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. You've had to be very cognizant of how you can train a model to do exactly what you need it to, because, of course, there's only so much time and there's only so many resources. So the more strategic you are in training your model within the confines of a PhD degree or timeline, right, you're able to create excellent results without having to, as you said, find every annotated CT scan or get clinicians to annotate even more CT scans than they actually need to be able to create a really effective tool. And I have a question, because I know CT scans come from different hospitals, different regions, different settings. And of course, you know, some hospitals are much better resourced than others and maybe have cutting edge tools, and others are maybe working with a machine that they've had for decades that, you know, might be quite a bit older in the technology compared to some of the newer sites. So how does your research make sure that your AI tool works reliably across all of these different variations in CT scans and in data?
Absolutely, yeah. So in real life, the CT scans are not polished, are not neat. And there are lots of standardized methods that we are needed to pre-process those images. And as you mentioned, different hospitals, institutes, they use different scanners, models, and imaging protocols. And for example, just to give you an idea, some scans have thicker slices, some are noisier, and the contrast timing can vary between all those scanners. So if you train an AI model only on data from one place, it might perform very well on that specific those collected data, but fail quietly when you take it to the another hospital. So that's super important that the model be robust and generalized as much as possible. So a part of my research addresses this in a few ways. First, I work with multi-institutional data sets. For example, in my case, I collected data from, I have data data from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, MSKCC, located in New York, which has largest cancer centers, data cancer institute in the world, and also other cancer centers in Europe. And then I have collected data from different cancer centers and different machines. And the model that I have been trained actually sees a range of the scanners and protocols during the training process. So these exposures help the model to learn features that are more about the underlying anatomy and disease than about a single scanner's quirks. And second is that I use pre-processing and data augmentation strategies to kind of normalize and diversify the training data. For example, we resample scans to a consistent resolution and apply intensity normalization schemes that reduce the impact of different scanners settings. So that during the training process, I also apply random transformations such as like changes in the contrast or slight spatial distortions to each of the input training images. So the model learns to be robust to those variations. And the third one, as I said, is self-supervised learning approaches, which also helps to build and train a generalized model. Because the model is trained to understand the broad structure of the CT images across many unlabeled scans, so it is less likely to latch on to narrow and site-specific artifacts. Instead, it learns general patterns that transfer better between the hospitals. So by placing a lot of emphasis on after training the model and validate the model on external validation, external data set, or in simpler words, on a data set that are actually unseen to the data I used during the training process, I could have a better understanding how the model could work in real world application, because I assess the model and evaluate the model on the unseen data, which gives me a much more closest to the real world accuracy and performance of the model.
Oh yeah, no, so it makes, again, it makes a lot of sense, right? You're being strategic with how you train the model, when you introduce it to different things, and challenge it to make sure that it is being accurate across all these different variables. Like you said, I'm taking the noise out of this, the different data that you're working with. Yeah. So this sounds very promising, right? So it's very exciting to hear about this work. And you mentioned real world application, right? And this is very, very real world applicable. Yeah. So when you look to the future, how do you imagine your tool or tools like the ones that you're building being used in everyday hospitals or cancer clinics? And what difference do you hope they make for patient and care teams in the future?
So when I think about the future, at this time, I do not imagine a hospital where AI actually replaces clinicians. Instead, I imagine a hospital where AI is doing a lot of the background work, many of those repetitive works, so that the clinician can focus on the parts that truly require human judgment and communication. And it helps to optimize the process and less burden on the clinician, just do all of those background and pre-processing steps. For example, in a typical liver cancer clinic, radiologists might open a CT scan and find that the system has already segmented the liver and also outlined all the visible tumors and calculated basic statistics such as the total tumor volume and how that has changed since the last scan. This actually helps the radiologist to have a clear quantitative starting point, which is not currently available to them, so that they could quickly see whether the automated measurements match their own impression, and then spend time and energy on the nuanced interpretation and also designing the treatment plan for that a specific patient, which is actually under the category of the personalized treatment plan. Mm-hmm. And also, on the other side, surgeons could also use these tools to visualize tumor burden in 3D and simulate different resection strategies. As well as oncologists could use the predicted and generated risk scores, as well as the tumor type classifications, as one part of their decision-making toolkit when choosing treatment or planning follow-up schedules. Mm-hmm. Also, as on the other cases, many specialists, they could discuss complex cases having consistent quantitative imaging data that helps them to make decisions or informed decision and focus on the evidence-based. And also, I wanted to highlight on a patient level that impact or in the future type of the technologies, they actually being helped them to ideally show up as a more timely and consistent care for the patients. Because if AI can help can catch subtle changes earlier or reduce the variation between readers, mm-hmm. then the patients are less likely to fall through the cracks because someone was overloaded or because two hospitals interpreted scans mm-hmm. differently. So it might also make clinical trials more efficient and fair, as well as by actually standardizing how tumors are being measured and also tracked. So these are some future beneficial benefits that could help both the clinicians and also the patients.
No, that sounds great. So it again, it's not taking away anything from the human approach of medicine. It's just offering tools to take away time that's spent on really repetitive tasks that take a lot of time. And in the healthcare setting, as we all know right now, no one has enough time for anything. So your tools can help assist doctors in spending the time with their patients and with that really personalized, individualized care that a specialist can provide, as well as, you know, making sure that, like you said, fairness for patients. You know, if one hospital has the newest, best equipment that gives the most accurate picture, a patient at a hospital with an older machine might still be able to get the same high quality care with your tool, even if the image itself to the human eye isn't as strong as that new technology at another hospital might be.
Yeah, that's exactly. Overall, you know, it helps to have a more consistent mm-hmm. and more reliable and also more efficient process for the patient, which can save lives. Mm-hmm. And this is very important. So that I think this technology could be deployable into the current clinical workflow. And I'm hoping this happens in a very soon years mm-hmm. to kind of being accessible to all patients. That being used as an AI-based assistant to all clinicians and doctors.
No, that sounds really exciting. I hope we see it Absolutely. Transition
yeah.
as you finish up your PhD. Hopefully, we'll see your PhD work move into clinical settings very soon. Well, Ramtin, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been great chatting with you, and good luck with the rest of your research.
Thank you so much. I appreciate for the time and opportunity, and thanks for having me.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
That in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water.
This is Eli with Off the Record on CFRC 101.9 FM. Tune in every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for a wide range of alternative music and just whatever I feel like. And remember,
this is Strictly Off the Record.
CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st. Help us raise $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and event listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win. Thank you for your support.
Good afternoon. My name is Bruce Swan. I graduated in Commerce 72. And I'm back after 53 years of being away from Queens. And I'm listening to CFRC. And when I was at Queens, I listened to CFRC. And so I'm glad to be here.
Today on Wings, a memory from the UN Fourth World Conference on Women. Muslim feminist theologian Rifat Hassan tells how sexism crept into Islam.
If you will not take the challenge of religion and feminist theology seriously, there is no other way of liberating Muslim women.
There's a river of birds in migration.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
God created all human beings at the same time, in the same manner, no difference whatsoever. Now, if that be the case, why is it and how is it that virtually every Muslim that I have ever met believes that woman was created from the rib of Adam? Have they been reading Genesis? No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
The following remarks were made by Professor Rifat Hassan of the University of Louisville at the non-governmental forum of the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. My understanding of the task assigned to presenters in this plenary was to give a critical review or overview of strategies which may be used to counter the various forms of conservatism which are having a negative impact on significant numbers of women in the contemporary world. Since I have been engaged since 1974 in developing the discipline of feminist theology in the context of Islam, a few words about how I became involved in a task which has been so central to my life journey may be useful as an introduction to my research and reflections which I would like to share with you this morning. Experientially, I have always known what it means to be a Muslim woman. I come from a Sayyid Muslim family. Sayyids are the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be on him. I come from Lahore, a historic Muslim city, which is in Pakistan, a country created in the name of Islam, so you cannot get much more Muslim than that. However, it was not until 1974 when I was teaching at Oklahoma State University in a place called Stillwater, Oklahoma, a place which lives up to its name, my career as a feminist theologian began almost accidentally and perhaps even against my will. As on many campuses across the United States, on this particular campus, there was a chapter of what was known then as Muslim Student Association, which was the largest body of Muslim students in North America. It was the policy of this particular university that every student body or chapter had to have a faculty advisor, and that particular year I happened to be the only Muslim faculty member on campus. And so I became the advisor to this group that was extremely patriarchal in its orientation. It consisted almost entirely of Arab students from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, and they were not overly thrilled to have me as their faculty advisor. It was the tradition of this group that later in fall each year they had a seminar, an annual seminar, at which it was customary for the faculty advisor to make a presentation on the theme of the seminar. I was asked by the students to make a presentation on the subject of women in Islam. That was not the theme of the seminar. But I was asked to talk about that topic because they thought that, well, what else could she talk about, even though I was the professor of Islamic studies, but they didn't think I was competent to talk about anything else. I did understand the insinuation beneath the invitation and was a bit resentful. However, I accepted the invitation for two reasons. One was that this group was so patriarchal in its orientation, it did not allow women even in the audience. Many of these men had wives, but they were not allowed to be in the audience. And many of them felt that it was haram or impermissible for them to hear a woman's voice because it would put their soul in mortal jeopardy. So I said, well, that's good. At least they'll have to hear my voice. Secondly, I had come across so many articles, books and brochures, hundreds of them, on the topic of the status and role and position of women, Muslim women or women in Islam, virtually all of them by Muslim men. I had not come across a single publication on the subject of the role or status or position of man in Islam, and had come to feel perhaps that men didn't have any status or role or position. And my dream is one day perhaps to return the favor and allocate some sort of role to them. But anyhow, until such time as that happens, I thought that it would be interesting to reflect on this question from a woman's point of view. That's how this journey started. I had a pretty good idea of what the students expected me to say, and I wasn't going to say that. What was I going to say? I had used the Quran, which for Muslims is the primary source of Islam. Islam has, by the way, four sources which are ranked in a certain order. The highest of these sources is the Quran, which Muslims believe to be God's word, transmitted through the agency of Archangel Gabriel to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be on him, who then transmitted it to the Muslims. Then comes what is called the prophetic example, consisting of the hadith and the sunnah, the oral and the practical traditions of the Prophet. And then come ijma, which is consensus of the community, and ijtihad, which is independent reasoning. So basically, both ijma and ijtihad collectively represent the application of human reason. Anyhow, I used the Quran as a textbook in my courses on Islam, but I had not up till that time done a systematic study of the Quranic passages relating to women, which I started to do at that time. And that is when my life took an entirely different turn. Because the deeper I got into this study, the more angry I became. And I became very angry because of two reasons. One, because I began to perceive very clearly the discrepancy or the wide gulf between Quranic ideals or norms of what the Quran was saying about the rights of women and what was actually happening to Muslim women in various Muslim societies. And secondly, because I began to realize for the first time in my life how many things had happened to me personally because I had been born female in a Muslim society. Now, the anger that I felt then has stayed with me all through these years, though it has taken different forms. And as one of my colleagues said earlier, anger, I believe, can be a very constructive force for change. It depends on what you do with it. Since that time, since 1974, I have been engaged in this study. For me, this study has always been very deeply rooted existentially. It was not an academic study. It was never an academic study. And for about a period of 10 years between 1974 and about 1983-84, it was for me a very private study. I was doing it, sort of as an Odyssean venture in self-understanding, trying to understand my own life as a Muslim woman. But enlightenment does not always lead to endless bliss. That has not been my experience. I realized more and more how patriarchal the Islamic tradition had become. Unlike Catholicism, Islam had not always been conservative. The early centuries of Islam were characterized by tremendous cultural diversity, by the right of dissent, by openness to dialogue, and that is why the Muslims, during the first 300 years, were able to create not only the largest empire that has ever existed territorially, extending from Spain to India, but they had created a civilization which has been one of the greatest in the world in terms of its art, its architecture, its philosophy, its literature, its scientific achievements, and so on. So that there had been a different kind of a history in the early centuries of Islam. Also in early Islam, there had been many outstanding women, such as Khadija and Aisha, the wives of the Prophet, peace be on him, and Rabia, the most outstanding Sufi woman in an age of saints. However, after the first 300 years, when the so-called gates of ijtihad or independent inquiry were closed due to a variety of reasons that I cannot investigate at this point due to shortage of time, the Islamic tradition has remained rigidly patriarchal, and Muslim men have arrogated to themselves the task of defining the ontological, theological, sociological, and eschatological status of Muslim women. So this study of mine continued for about 10 years, until I went to Pakistan for a period of 2 years between 1983 and 84. Now, at this point, this country was undergoing a massive wave of what has come to be known as the Islamization process. And already in 1979, under the rule of General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq, the Hudud Ordinance had been passed, according to which, in all the Hud crimes, which include the crime of rape and murder, a woman's evidence is not admissible. So that a woman who was raped could not testify on her own behalf, and the only way that her evidence would become admissible would be if the crime was reduced from a Hadd to a Tazir crime. Not only was this simply a matter of the passing of some laws, but in the wake of these laws, there was a tremendous wave of violence towards women and the appearance of anti-women literature all over the place. And there were many, many cases of brutality towards women. In response to all of these, a women's movement was born. In fact, for many years in that country under martial law, the women's movement was the only living thing that was happening. However, despite the fact that many of these women were very valiant and they fought in all the ways that they knew how to fight, held processions, they had rallies, they had press conferences, nonetheless, they were not able to reverse this sort of anti-women legislation. And some of them came to me at that time and asked me, because I had been engaged in this study, rather privately, but nevertheless people knew about it, or some people knew about it, to provide them with an ideology for their movement. Now for me, this was a tremendously important moment. It was a moment of history, because this study that I had done out of my personal passion or quest had acquired a political and social meaning that I could never have imagined. At this point, I had to rethink many things. One thing that I had been doing for 10 years had been to give alternative interpretations of the Quranic passages that had been used against women. And I could do that. That work had already been done. And this is what some of my feminist activist friends wanted me to do. However, the question that I became very interested in, that really began to intrigue me, was a larger and a more profound question. And the question was the following. The question was, how is it possible in Pakistan, which is a progressive Muslim country, for such archaic and unjust laws to be passed in 1983 and 84? How is it possible? As I reflected on this question, the answer that came to me with a stunning clarity was a very simple answer. But sometimes it takes us forever to see the simplest things. The answer was as follows. It is regarded as self-evident in all Muslim societies that men are superior to women and women are inferior to men. Men believe it and women believe it, so what's the problem about institutionalizing this belief in all kinds of laws? And this is what was happening. But then this is, of course, not the end of the question, because beliefs and ideas also have their history. So the question is, where did this idea that men are superior to women and women are inferior to men come from? And that was the question that I became interested in and that I began to investigate. And in investigating that, I expanded my field of study spent several months doing a very systematic and exhaustive study of the two most important hadith collections in Sunni Islam, namely Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, which are next in authority only to the Quran. I also made a rereading of many of the Christian feminist theologians like Phyllis Trible, Rosemary Ruther, and others who had done I think there's something wrong with your watch because I started speaking at 10:07. I know, I'm sorry. I'm watching the time. Thank you. I think Muslim women have had a very short shrift in this world anyway, so kindly allow me to finish. At the end of this period of study, I identified three theological assumptions that, in my judgment, underlie not only discrimination against women in the Islamic tradition, but also in the Jewish and Christian tradition. These three theological assumptions are as follows. Number one, that God's primary creation was Adam, that Adam was a male person, and that from the rib of this male person, God created Eve, who was a female person, and therefore Eve is secondary and derivative and subordinate. This is the issue of woman's creation. Number two, that though Eve was secondary in creation, she was primary in guilt insofar as the so-called fall episode was concerned because she got poor Adam thrown out of paradise. We all know the story. And because of that, daughters of Eve are always to be treated with hatred, ridicule, and contempt. And there's a whole baggage of feminine evil and gullibility and weakness attached to this story. And the third theological assumption is that not only was woman created from Adam, but she was created for Adam, which makes her instrumental and makes him fundamental. Now, since 1984 to the present time, I have been working on these three myths, and I have, in fact, written a book on the first one, which is called Equal Before Allah? The issue of man-woman equality in terms of creation. Now, in order to show to you how feminist theology is effective and is perhaps the only way to bring about change in the Muslim world, I would like to take a few minutes to share with you some of the methodology that I have used in working out this issue. If one asks the average Muslim about the creation of woman, you know, you ask a simple question, how was woman created? The answer comes back without the blinking of an eye. The answer is from the rib of Adam. Now, what's wrong with this answer? There's something profoundly wrong with this answer. And what's wrong with this answer is as follows. This idea that God's primary creation was Adam and that the woman was created from the rib of Adam is not found in the Quran. There is, in fact, no Eve in the Quran at all. This idea comes from one of the two creation stories in the book of Genesis, which is the first book of the Bible. There are in the Bible two creation stories. There's one in chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, which is attributed to a writer called the priest. The story is dated the 5th century before the Christian era. And then there is a second story in chapter 2, which is attributed to another writer called the Yahvist. This is dated the 10th century before the Christian era. And this is a story that everybody in the world knows. And the story is God created Adam, no suitable companion for Adam was to be found. So Adam was lonely, God put Adam to sleep, and while Adam slept, God created woman from the rib of Adam, and when Adam awoke, he was overjoyed, and he broke out into a song of celebration, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, thou art, and you all know the story. It is impossible for me to tell you the impact, the negative impact of the way that this story has been interpreted through 2,000 years of Christian history. From the time of St. Paul, who was the first formulator of the Christian tradition, who said in 1 Corinthians 11:3 to 9, he's talking about, he says, God is the head of Christ, Christ is the head of man, man is the head of woman. I do not allow a woman to pray or prophesy with her head uncovered. If she will not cover her head, she must shave off her head, which was a sign that you were a harlot in Israel. And that a woman must cover her head, but a man must not cover his head, for a man is made in the image of God and reflects God's glory, but a woman is made in the image of man and reflects man's glory. And the clinching argument is for woman came from man, not man from woman. Woman is responsible for the fall, and woman was created for the sake of man, or not the other way around. So what has happened here is there's been a creation of a hierarchy. God, Christ, man, woman. Woman is always at the bottom. Now, again, due to shortage of time, I cannot share with you the historical development of this idea, but it runs like a refrain through the Christian tradition, and it was also then taken into the Jewish tradition and the Islamic tradition. If you look at the Quranic accounts of human creation. There are 30 creation stories in the Quran, not one, but 30. The Quran, of course, is not structured like the Bible. It's not chronological. It's not historical. So it's more like wisdom literature. It has different accounts. But in none of these 30 accounts of creation is there any mention of a male creation first and a female creation second. In all of these 30 passages, what you have are three generic terms for humanity: An-Nas, Al-Bashr, and Al-Insan. So what these 30 creation stories are saying is that God created all human beings at the same time, in the same manner, no difference whatsoever. Now, if that be the case, why is it and how is it that virtually every Muslim that I have ever met believes that woman was created from the rib of Adam? Have they been reading Genesis? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I would have not read Genesis if I had not been sent to an Anglican missionary school where I am told my undoing began. But anyhow, so the story come from? Well, the story came from the hadith literature, from six hadiths in particular that are found, three in Sahih al-Bukhari and three in Sahih Muslim. And again, for want of time, I would love to share with you all of these hadiths, but I will leave out a part of it. Each hadith, that is, each tradition that is attributed to the Prophet of Islam, is divided into two parts. The first part consists of isnad, which is a list of names of transmitters of that hadith, and the second consists of matn, the content. I will just read to you the content, which is very brief. Treat women nicely, for a woman is created from a rib, and the most curved portion of the rib is its upper portion. So if you should try to straighten it, it will break. But if you leave it as it is, it will remain crooked. So treat women nicely. Number two, the woman is like a rib. If you try to straighten her, she will break. So if you want to get benefit by her, do so while she still has some crookedness. Number three, whoever believes in Allah in the last day should not trouble his neighbor. And I advise you to take care of women, for they are created from a rib. And the most crooked part of the rib is its upper part. If you try to straighten it, it will break. And if you leave it, it will remain crooked. So I urge you to take care of women. These three are from Sahih al-Bukhari. Four, woman is like a rib. When you attempt to straighten it, you would break it. And if you leave her alone, you would benefit by her, and crookedness will remain in her. Number five, woman has been created from a rib and will in no way be straightened for you. So if you wish to benefit by her while crookedness remains in her. And if you attempt to straighten her, you will break her. And breaking her is divorcing her. Number six, he who believes in Allah and the hereafter, if he witnesses any matter, he should talk in good terms about it or keep quiet. Act kindly towards women, for woman is created from a rib, and the most crooked part of the rib is its top. If you attempt to straighten it, you would break it. And if you leave it, its crookedness will remain there. These are from Sahih Muslim. If I were to do content analysis, it would take a long time. Let me just point out a couple of things. Here, this is the rib story entering the Islamic tradition. I cannot give a date on it because no research has been done on it. But what's interesting is it that even as the story is being co-opted into the Islamic tradition, it's changing. Because here you have the mention, there is no mention in any of these six hadiths of Adam. So this is now a disembodied rib. It could be anything's rib. This is a further dehumanization of woman. Secondly, there is the mention of crookedness in each of these hadiths. Now, how do you interpret that? Now, in terms of Islamic scholarship and in terms of belief system, if there is one Quranic statement which is clear, that holds, and not 1 million hadiths can supersede it or can overturn it. This is what all Muslims accept. And yet, this is a clear example where 30 creation stories, which are totally egalitarian, have been overturned by the hadith literature. This is a clear example of how it has happened. Now, from a scholarly point of view, you say, well, you reject the hadiths. But the hadiths have become so ingrained and they have penetrated Muslim culture so deeply that it is not simply a matter of rejecting hadith. Furthermore, hadith cannot be rejected according to Islamic scholarship unless you prove that there are weaknesses in the isnad. Now, in my book and through my research, I show that these hadiths should be rejected also on accounts of weakness in the isnad. Now, the question arises, why did I do this research? You know, my friends who were activists in the street were getting a bit impatient with me. And they were saying, here we are on the streets, we are being lathi charged, we are being put in jail and so on, and here you are talking about Adam and Eve. Get real. And I said to them, but you know, I am, this is very real. And I presented to them two separate ideas, which I would like to present to you for your consideration. One is, why I think the creation issue is so important. You see, if God created man and woman equal, which is the clear teaching of the Quran, if God created man and woman absolutely equal, then if they subsequently become unequal in human society, which they have virtually everywhere, this cannot be said to be the will of God. On the other hand, if God did not create men and women equal, which is what the majority of Muslims, Jews, Christians believe, then if you try to make them equal, as some of these perverse feminists are trying to do, that is against the will of God. So what you believe about creation is the most important and basic theological point here. Secondly, Santayana said, those who do not know their history are destined to repeat it. Okay? Another thought for you. A Quranic scholar once said to me, if you are traveling, if you're going somewhere on a train, and somehow the train gets off the track, it becomes derailed, and you start going in some other direction, and you realize after you've gone astray for 20 miles that you are not on the right track, you cannot at that point get back on track. What you have to do is you have to go back to the point at which you became derailed, and then you get back on track. My sisters, my contention is that women, all of us, we got derailed at the very start. And unless we go back to that point of derailment, we are not going to get back on track. And finally, I would like to say this. Why is this the strategy that I'm advocating? Why am I not supporting some other strategies? There are other people. There are many women's rights activists and human rights activists. Say, for example, in Pakistan, which is my country of origin, take the position that human rights and Islam are incompatible. If you want to work for women's liberation, you have to do it outside the framework of Islam. I disagree with that position, both personally on, as a matter of faith, but also on a very important pragmatic ground. And the ground is as follows. The average Muslim woman has three characteristics. There are 500 million Muslim women in the world. The characteristic of an average Muslim woman is three. She is poor, she's illiterate, and she lives in a village. Now, if I, as an activist, as a woman's right or human rights activist, want to liberate this Muslim woman who lives in any village from Ankara to Jakarta, how am I going to communicate with her? Can I go to her and say, I am bringing you liberation in the name of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 1948? Is that going to make sense to her? It's not, because she doesn't understand what that is. It's not relevant to her life. But I can say to her, look, you believe in God. You believe in the justice of God. If you believe that the Quran is the word of God, which you do believe, the Quran cannot be then used as a means of perpetrating any kind of injustice. In fact, the Quran is a guarantor of all the fundamental human rights, if you read the Quran with an open point of view. Many analysts, including many analysts in the West and Western media, have done a tremendous job of Islam bashing and Muslim bashing, including the bashing of Muslim women. Case in point, Bosnian Muslim women's rape, the burning of Turkish girls in Germany, and so on. There's not enough time to dwell on all that aspect. But I just want to say the following. There are many people who are very disturbed by this sort of an approach. In the West particularly, and I've lived in the West for 31 years of my life, so I know this very well. If one is perceived as a woman, as a Muslim woman who is deviant, who is in defiance against her own tradition, you get a lot of support. And you get, you have the support on account of being perceived as the poor, oppressed Muslim women. What I have tried to share with you is that Muslim women undoubtedly have very serious problems. Very serious problems in terms of gender inequity and so on. But my contention is that Muslim women, like African women, like Latin American women, like all the minority women, we must find the models of liberation within the framework of our belief system. The majority of the Muslims in the world, including Muslim women, and I'm talking about 95% and more, are believers, whatever their belief system might be, or whatever the details are. So that is, in order to understand Muslim women, in order to understand their plight, and in order to understand and help them develop some sort of a framework of liberation, one has to understand that in the context of the Islamic world, religion is not just a factor. It's not like the economic factor and the political factor and the social factor and the cultural factor. Religion is the matrix in which the lives of Muslims are rooted. So if you will not take the challenge of religion and feminist theology seriously, there is no other way of liberating Muslim women.
Rifat Hassan spoke on a panel about the rise of conservatism in Huairou, China, September 4, 1995. Reporting for Wings, this is Mary O'Grady.
Rifat Hassan is a Pakistani-American theologian and scholar of the Quran. Her bio is in Wikipedia. Her name is spelled Rifat Hassan. I'm Frieda Worden. I recorded this talk in Huairou, China, at the 4th UN World Conference on Women in 1995. It's one of my favorites. Wings thanks all our supporters, including the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, USA Chapter, your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. Serving community radio since 1986, we are the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.